All right, then. Cheerful banter aside, how about we jump right in? You guys good?
Yep.
All
right. Hey, folks. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the BAMF Podcast. We've got kind of a publisher's roundtable here today. First off, a new guest, Mr. Gobian Rowlands from I'm sorry, I just slaughtered your last name, from Oxford, England.
Yep. It's okay. You got my name right.
Okay, cool. Gobian is a novelist and a game designer. He has written the Broken Shield RPG, which is being released by Chronicle City. And he's also written several novels, The Wild Hunt being the one that's available right now on RPG Now through its fiction. And you can also get that on Amazon as well, where it's got several five-star reviews. Gobian, we were talking about before the show. What other novels do you have available right now?
Well, as well as The Wild Hunt, there's also Dead Angels, which is a short novella prequel as a kind of easy intro to my universe, just as to get it out there. And then I've got coming out later this year, The Firestorm Conspiracy, which is a novel set after The Wild Hunt, almost immediately after, in fact.
Okay, and these are all set in the world of Broken Shield.
Yeah, they're all sci-fi, noir, detective thrillers with a superhero element. Well, a superpower. Someone described it as superpunk the other day, which is a new concept to me. But
I wanted to ask you about that because I saw on one of the forums they were describing our Broken Shield as a superpunk setting, and I had never.
Yeah. That's I'd never heard of it either until it got described by other people. But that's one of the things I always like about these things is seeing how, you know, other people reflect on your work. Having my game and world described as superpunk is kind of along the same lines as all the whenever I'm writing anything, I always illustrate the characters first. And when I showed like readers of my books the pictures of the characters, they've pretty much always gone, nope, that's not them. Even though I've described them as the ones I wrote, so it's kind of one of those things that I'm always intrigued by how other people perceive the stuff I make.
Yeah, once it's in the audience's hands, they can do whatever they want with it, really. So
yeah, and it's really exciting for that. It's one of the things I really love.
Yeah. Well, and we also have a recurring guest, Mr. Andrew Collis. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm good. How are you doing, Mr. Lafferty?
I am highly caffeinated, but otherwise super. And speaking of highly caffeinated, Mr. Walt Rebilliard.
That's right. I currently have an IV, and I'm pushing it as hard as I can.
Walt works the night shift. So, Andrew,
yep.
As we mentioned before in the podcast, Andrew and Walt are also kind of dabbling in the superhero. Well, you guys are both foot jumping into the superhero genre with the heroic comic book that's being kickstarted as we speak.
Yep, he's super. I'm the punk.
Cool.
I refuse to agree to that.
Excellent.
And before we jump into talking about Broken Shield, do you want to refresh the listeners' memories a little bit about what's going on with Heroic and what the vibe is there?
Sure, it'd be my pleasure actually to jump in all over that while Walt caffeinates himself, though I think you should change your name to Wolf. It sounds better. Basically what we're doing is we have to sum up Heroic in a nutshell, I'm tired of what I'm seeing in superhero comics. I see in the indie market some of the most amazing things being done, not specifically in superheroes, but just in general comics. You know, like, they're really making good comics these days, and superhero comics have just started going downhill. It's almost like we're back in that mid-90s gritty deconstructionism where they just sort of, they've lost their way, and I don't like it. So Walt and I kind of shanghaied Walt into helping me, and from there it grew, and now we're trying to produce the first issue of our comic Heroic, where we take the world as is for superheroes, so a darker, grittier, harder-edged world. We postulate the theory, what if Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex had also included superhumans? Let's see if we can make the heroes change the world and make them more heroic.
Oh, excellent. And you're on Kickstarter right now, and you're aiming for about 10 grand, and you're about halfway there with about 2 weeks left to go.
Yeah, and I do have to say, a few people said, well, you guys really want a lot of money. And all I can say is that we've listed on the page of our Kickstarter our costs. I and Walt and I, who have both put money in as well as a couple of other partners, we will make no money off of this if we succeed. Our artist will get paid, our colorist will get paid, our letterer will get paid, the printing company will get paid, the USPS will certainly get paid to get those comics out to everybody. Walt, myself, and the three other partners who've all put money into the company will not get one penny. We'll make our money hopefully selling the comic later to other buyers. But that's the point. This is a labor of love for us. We are doing this, we are putting our lives into this solely to get this product out there because man, be the change you want to see in the world, I guess, you know? That's what it boils down to.
Oh, cool, 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 cool. And I'll make sure I have that link up in the show notes. Okay, let's focus on Gobian a little bit.
Yeah.
So the Broken Shield RPG is available now on RPG Now, and I'm guessing you guys will be in game stores shortly?
Yeah, it's going out to distribution at the moment. We're selling direct order hardbacks through the Chronicle City store and at conventions, but we're also the softbacks going out to stores around the world.
Okay, excellent, excellent. And now, like we mentioned before, I mean, your book draws a lot of comparisons with people use the phrase diesel punk, and looking at some of your description pages of your novels and some of the reviews on Amazon, you get compared favorably to Jim Butcher, Richard Morgan, Mike Carey, Charles Strauss. How would you, as a writer, describe the world of Broken Shield?
The world of Broken Shield is kind of like you were mentioning with the comic book. It's like it's been a labor of love for me, like, for many, many years, and it's. Essentially, it started with the question of, you know, in the mid-90s, I was, you know, I was really into kind of cyberpunk games and the like, but I was kind of disturbed by how, like, the superhero conventions were going. I kind of got really tired of four-color superheroes. I'd grown up in the comics book world of artists like Drouillet in France and 2000 AD in the UK, and kind of more less US style comics. And I was kind of curious about what could you do with superpowered people who kind of have to live real worlds and real lives, and how can they kind of, you know, how does that affect society around them? How do you think these things through to their logical conclusion when you can have people that can destroy entire kind of cities? And then that kind of built up on the idea that, you know, I was always intrigued in some of the themes in classic works like Dune, about how things like the spice destroyed people over time. And I was thinking about, you know, what's the cost of having these kind of special abilities? So it was all about kind of exploring the humanity at the core of, you know, superpowers, but then that combined with that, my kind of love of mystery writing and noir fiction and, you know, H.P. Lovecraft, like everyone else in the industry, kind of blended it all together to kind of create this sort of sci-fi noir setting.
Cool. And London is the setting for all your for the game and then the books.
Yep.
As well, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you write about what you know. And I was playing all these games like Shadowrun set in Seattle, you know, Cyberpunk set in Night City, reading books, you know, they're all set at where the authors know. And I when I was kind of formulating Broken Shield, when I was really inspired by it, I was living in an apartment in the center of London in Soho, and the view out of my window was at this complete Blade Runner-esque scene. Every morning I woke up and there were, like, you know, there was three bridges going across between two kind of theaters, and then there was a view of a building that was always kind of lit by floodlights, and there were neons in the streets, and people would be hurrying back and forth eating noodles, and just, you know, because it was in the heart of Chinatown, and it was impossible not to be inspired by that. And I kind of thought, you know, if I'm going to make this, if I'm going to write about it, I really need to kind of play with the area I know, you know, play with the genre conventions, play with the location conventions. So, you know, I twist things around. So, like, in real London, Hampstead, for instance, is like a, you know, it's on a hill, but because of the upward building of London in the Steel Alliance universe of Broken Shield, it's actually in a valley, and it's kind of this secluded valley surrounded by huge tall cities and stuff. So it was it was very always going to be focused on what I knew and my influences, and it was kind of me blending the influences of growing up in London, but also I grew up and I spent a lot of time in my childhood growing up in the far north of Sweden, up in the Arctic, and, you know, tracking deer and elk, and kind of I was brought up with the myths and sagas of the Vikings, and it kind of all kind of came together in my head, you know, to influence one another. So it's trying to get those mythical tales in an urban setting.
Wow. Yeah. So where do I get your book? I want to read this. I got to say, like, you're hitting so many little buttons that I love that I'm like, okay, all right, where do I get it?
Yeah, well, as Mike mentioned, it's available on Amazon Kindle and through Delta 14 Publishing, which I'm a co-owner of with Angus. I've been getting a really good review, you know, really good response from it, and it's great. I mean, you know, I write because I love writing. The commercial side of it is a distant second. But it's just so exciting to share my world with a wider audience. And, that's where I come from. So, that's why I write under I have a pen name as well, because the reason I write my novels is I write under the pen name of Gunnar Roxon. And part of that is Gunnar's my middle name, and Roxon's the lake I grew up by in Sweden. And, it's natural for a Scandinavian to be writing kind of slightly dark mystery novels, I think. That's thematically appropriate. But also, it's kind of a homage to my grandfather who taught me all these skills. He was quite a character. He was a Air Force policeman and a volunteer fireman. He was terrified of heights and scared to death of fires. And he was one of those people who's always like, you've got to do what scares you the most. And so he filled me with these kind of tales. So, I wrote under the pen name, partly because, it's as a homage to him, but also helps deal with kind of criticism. But also I wanted people to know that when they were buying a Gunnar Roxon book, they were getting a sci-fi noir novel. So I guess it's a little bit of branding.
My friend, I got to interrupt you here. I'm a Celtic Viking. I'm of Irish-Danish descent, okay?
Oh, yeah.
I have fully embraced both aspects of my heritage and my people. Everything you're saying is making me smile and chuckle and giggle. I grew up in rural Canada, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And
parts of Canada that aren't considered rural?
Shut up, laugh.
Cheap shots.
Jesus. Cheap shot. We're the only country in the world that's kicked your ass in a fight. Keep that in mind. I swear to you, man.
Somewhere a Vietnamese guy is looking up and arching one eyebrow. Well, please continue.
That was a stalemate. anyway, I swear to you, I am so going to have one of my characters listening to their favorite Scandinavian death metal band called The Wild Hunt, led by lead singer Gunnar Roxon, because that's just amazing to me.
Oh, cool, yeah. No, I grew when the town I grew up in Sweden was called Vikingstad, which is Viking town. And
yeah,
I grew
yeah.
up on the corner of Thor Street and Odin Street, and the whole town was, the town hall was called Valhalla, and I was surrounded by runestones. So it's kind of like, it's impossible for it not to have been embedded completely in my psyche. So, yeah.
Why do I live in Canada?
Yeah, it's just a shame, living in modern Oxford, you kind of have to suppress the urge to go and pillage every so often.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pondering building a longboat at some point.
Yeah. Okay, you guys just keep talking. I'm just going to sit here and smile a lot.
All right, then. So, let's talk about game stuff. What kind of system have you devised for Broken Shield?
Well, rather than use a kind of generic system, this is the seventh iteration of the system, so it's been polished over years. It's its own system thematically tied into the universe. It's sort of a D20 based system with lots of D6 for damage. So kind of pretty straightforward stuff, but a lot of the elements of design I've been fed into by my because I worked in the video games industry for 15 years, and so I've taken a lot of elements from visual approach in video games to how I can use those in role-playing games. So for instance, all the echo powers, the superpower stuff, is all resolved very visually using a kind of what's called an echo wheel. And it was one of the things that my wife always pointed out, is whatever games we were playing, it's like whatever the magic system would always take 10 times longer than any other part of the game to work out what you were going to do and how you're going to tune it. And I wanted to kind of improve on that because, superpowers and psionics and stuff, they're all versions of a theme. It's its own system. I kind of kept it streamlined. And this is the first version I felt was, up to my standards to kind of release publicly. I also ported the entire game over to Savage Worlds at one point because I wanted to see what were the kind of key elements to bring across. And that was an interesting exercise, and I may release that at some point as well, but basically it's its own homebrew system.
Okay, cool. Yeah, Savage Worlds has a huge fan base, so you see a lot of conversions going on. That'd be kind of fun.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned Echoes. I read the introduction to Broken Shield, but I think it'd be a lot more interesting to our listeners if you were to go into some detail about Echoes and kind of the Faustian deal they have with their powers.
So, in the universe, 1 in 50,000 people acquires these abilities to reshape the universe, and it's all done it's a kind of morphic universe. So, what you do is reflected by your perception. So, when they're exploring space, they were expecting to find colonizable worlds, so they found colonizable worlds. When an Echo thinks that he's acquired his power through some sort of pyrokinetic fire-based event, then all their powers are kind of filtered through that. But unlike in a lot of worlds, they, you know, they've got the power, a lot of worlds have, but one of the things they have is that every single time they use their abilities, they die a bit more. They acquire wild cancer, and it slowly burns them out. And the Faustian bargain is that the humanity, when Echoes manifested, they pretty much almost killed itself. And these creatures called the Disciples, led by one called the Overlord, turned up and basically said, you know, we'll make you a deal. We'll, you know, humanity can survive and prosper, but you have to have faith with us. You have to, you know, pledge yourself to us. And so it's just been this kind of deal with these kind of... It's a universe without any aliens, apart from possibly the Disciples, which may or may not be. Okay. There's lots of subspecies of humans, like the one of my main characters is a Pure, who are very kind of they're highly controlled because they're just seething, boiling fountains of rage, and so they're always trying to keep that in control. And they worship the Disciple of Judgment, Tattooed Man. So it's a universe where the gods are very much present. So there's no such thing as faith. There's more kind of respect and tolerance, I guess. But one of the things that happens in the system is that the good thing with what I wanted to do was I wanted I didn't like the way that, you know, level one, say, in a carrot game, you know, like you've got a pyrokinetic ability, level one, light match, level two, light box of matches, level three, light several boxes of matches. You know, it was quite a frustrating thing to play for a lot of players, especially when you play a short game. Right from the word go, when you play an Echo, if you're a pyrokinetic or a teleporter or, you know, metasensory perception, you can see through time. You can set fire to an entire city. You can, you know, teleport halfway across the universe. You can do incredible things right out of the bat. But the payoff is the charge is the wild cancer. So in the game, every Echo can take 500 points of wild cancer, and then they die explosively. And there's no way to avoid that. And every time you use your abilities, you acquire between 1 and 20. So you have to think, do I want to use this ability? Is it worth my life? But the thing is, it puts the power in the player's hands rather than the Games Master's hands. It's up to the players when they want to do it. Do they decide that this is important to them and they want to go for it? And the perverse thing that I have in the system is that the bigger the power, and it's the same in the universe, the bigger the power, the easier it is to do. The smaller and more controlled the power and the less wild cancer you take, the harder it is. So it's a horror. It can be quite a perverse Faustian deal with the Echo abilities. It's like, you know, every use is burning you up, but you can do so much. And so there's that interesting tension there. And even at the end, you know, one of my views is that when you're going to do horrible things to characters, you should make it fun for the players. So even in the last few stages of the Wild Cancer, where their character's glowing all the time, their eyes are glowing, they're irradiating everyone around them, you know, they are dying, they become more and more powerful. And of course, you know, until they finally go out with a boom, so they can literally shift, they potentially could shift entire worlds. And one of the things that thing kind of led to was, you know, thinking through the logical conclusion, and when you have those kind of Echo powers around, then you base your technology off them because they're the easiest resource. So all the technology, the jump drives, everything else that people use are based on Echoes. And then that means you need to have whole sorts of regulation about that. And, you know, you need these divisions of people to check on, to make sure they're not going out of control. So that's where Ripper come out and the training and this whole thing that Echoes go into the training, but only one in four at most survives the training because they cannot risk letting an uncontrolled Echo get out in the streets. And then that gives you sort of unregistered Echoes. So there's all these kind of layers to the onion, but it gives a lot of freedom to players when they play Echoes, or for instance, characters who are Slivers who are using cyberware and biological enhancements and gene sculpting. It's all sort of based on Echo tech, but it gives you lots of opportunities, and it puts the power firmly in the player's hand. But it does make for some interesting challenges for a Games Master. So for instance, if you've got a character who can see back through time and space and you're running an investigations mission, you know, how you have to think through how it works when they come along and they go, right, I'm going to scan the crime scene, I want to see who did it. And then this is the whole thing that, you know, some people can resist Echo powers. Echoes are very good at that, but normals aren't. And you kind of, there's all these kind of little dynamics in the game. And of course, the big risk is that every single time an Echo uses their ability, there is a chance that they will go out of control and what's called and wild, and just basically release a massive uncontrolled burst of energy that destroys everything around them except for them. They're unharmed, but all their friends, family, everything else generally are killed, which kind of puts them in a slightly precarious position in society because people both simultaneously envy them, want to be them, and are terrified of them. So it makes for some interesting dynamics in play.
Kind of reminds me of the old catchphrase for the X-Men, trying to protect a world that's sworn to protect a world that hates and fears them.
Yeah, except in this case, the world does hate and fear them, but you know, because they're so valuable as a resource, if you have organization, you know, they're always recruited by the agency, which the main organization you play in the game, in the core game, is the agency, which is federal. Across between like the FBI and the CIA, DEA, and all those kind of organizations. I guess it's everything that would fall under Homeland Security in the US now. But so you play a mixture of investigations and espionage missions, and you know those kind of organizations snap up echoes, and they tend to advance them fast and put them in positions of power. Of course, the thing I'm writing about in my current novel is the fact that you know you get whole swathes of normals who do hate and fear them, and so you end up with kind of anti-echo terrorists and pro-echo supremacists and all these kind of things. So it's, you know, exploring that. But it comes from a similar kind of way. I guess the main difference is that unlike the mutants in, say, X-Men and things, no one goes around in kind of costumes, for instance. You know, most of the time, like an echo is generally you're an agent, you're in investigations, solving crimes, who just happens to be able to set fire to cities or teleport across space. That kind of thing.
Interesting. And you mentioned jump drives. This is sort of a multi-planet kind of civilization going on at this point.
Yeah. It's set in the Steel Alliance, which is a 2,000-year-old fractured, loose alliance of states. It used to be one state, but it's had multiple civil wars, and it's colonized hundreds of thousands of planets. And being perverse like I am, I've set the core game on London, on Earth. But the rest of the universe is there. So Earth is essentially a dead death world. Most of Earth is actively hostile to humanity, and there's only a few kind of remaining cities, and it's kind of been left behind. It's no longer the core capital of the Steel Alliance, but it is like a heart of espionage because it's positioned in between several major states that are it's not a Cold War situation, but it's because there's more than two sides, but it's become a city of spies. And, you know, to keep it focused, the core book, which is, you know, based on my novels in this sense, is set in London. But future books will look at the wider universe. And I kind of, you know, I don't want to put stuff out there unless it feels solid and real. And so I start, a lot of the campaigns we've done when we've been playing Broken Shield with our groups have been things like playing, you know, London Metro Police patrol officers who are patrolling just a neighborhood. And yet other campaigns we've done have involved jumping world to world, epic sci-fi events. And in fact, I might do, on the novel side of things, I'm thinking about doing another series unrelated to the first series that'll deal with some of the kind of more sci-fi epic elements of the universe.
Oh, cool. Well, I kind of want to ask you more about that, but I know it's not particularly relevant to Broken Shield, so maybe we can save that for another podcast.
No, go for it. Oh. That's cool.
Well, I'm wondering if you're, you know, doing what they do, maybe say in Shadowrun or some other cyberpunk games where they extrapolate, you know, current situations into the far future, or if maybe because of all the changes to humanity, you know, modern nations don't have much relevance to what's going on in the, interplanetary stuff.
Definitely. I think that's one of the strengths of any sci-fi is taking issues that are very challenging in the real world and looking at them. I mean, one of the things I mentioned that the Firestorm Conspiracy is about, you know, officially about sort of terrorist events. What it's actually about is really looking at discrimination issues. That's a strong theme in there. It's like how, you know, when you have a society where less than a tiny fraction of 1% have these super abilities and are essentially, you know, a superpowered nobility of sorts. What is there for the rest of people? You know, where do they fit in it? How do they, you know, do they hit a glass ceiling? So it's sort of looking, addressing those kind of issues. And the thing about having both the novels and the game is I get to explore very different sides of the world because there's stuff that you just don't do in a day-to-day role-playing game session that you can explore in a novel, but likewise, you know, the other way around. So it's building. They're all kind of part of a whole world. The novels stand on their own. You don't have to know anything about the game or care about the game. But if you do, it's there and it's got more, you know, details. And I guess to a certain extent, I'm probably not revealing too much of some of the things in Broken Shield until they've kind of turned up in the novels, because I want to make sure I don't accidentally tie my hands when writing. So that's a tricky balance to maintain. But yeah, it's getting there. But, yeah.
Okay, cool. Andrew Walt, do you guys have anything?
Sadly, I think a lot of the stuff I'm going to talk about is about storytelling and specifically the novel and the setting in the world, so I'm not really much for a game mechanics type guy. I would like to comment on some stuff I heard you say, though, if that's okay.
Go for it.
I was very impressed to hear you say one specific thing that I wish more and more writers would say these days, which is that it had to work for you. It had to make sense for you. You had to be able to see it. Like, you don't put an idea out just because it sounds cool. You have to figure out how that idea seems works. And I really appreciate that, because my fiance cannot stand watching movies with me anymore, because the minute I see some lazy piece of ham-fisted writing that just gets you from point A to point B with no logic, no reason, or no ability to fit within the rest of the world they've created, I start yelling at the screen in my own home. I don't do it in public. And I just wish more writers would take the time to understand that, yes, emotional beats are lovely, but getting to them requires logical story beats that bring the reader and or viewer along on a voyage, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I mean, my first career, I trained as a forensic psychologist.
So, oh, wow.
You know, so I actually did work in criminal investigations and things. So it's very important for me to get that sense of fidelity in what I'm doing. I love to immerse. I love world building. I can't get enough of immersing myself in the universe. It's so, you know, we had these questions are so intriguing. I mean, we were playing a game of Torg recently, and we were playing a little short run. We dug that up from the 90s and thought, hey, we'll have a go at that. And we got devolved into this whole conversation of that one of the realms in it, one of the areas, is this part of America that has become this kind of dinosaur world, and basically technology stopped working. And we got into these discussions about, you know, how's that affected climate change? You know, and just like kind of random things like, you know, looking, what are the emissions from dead dinosaurs? That kind of thing. And it's just, nice. You know, about exploring, you know, what is possible in the universe. I mean, you know, as I say, it kind of has to make some logical sense. And, you know, that makes it, that's fun. And it's quite empowering as a writer. I think a lot of writers are scared of doing that because continuity can be very hard. Mm-hmm. So I make sure I keep, so for my writing and also for the games, I have a kind of, you know, a continuity Bible to remind myself about what I've said or where things have developed. But I always, one of my rules was whenever I was introducing a new rule into the game, was it had to explain the existing, the setup and what we did in the games and the sessions and the novels better than something that existed there already. My rule was that I wasn't allowed to replace elements of the background. I had to organically add to them, because that's how you kind of get a sense of depth. Because every so often there's a temptation as a writer in game design and novel writing to just sweep aside a whole section of the world and go, you know what, I'm just going to burn it away and I'm going to try that. And it's always a loss. It's always more interesting to explore the what ifs. If you clean slates are like a blank piece of paper, they're very hard to work with, whereas the constraints and the logical elements of thinking about, you know, how does, say, echo powers work, how does that relate to your society or whatever, that can actually really free you up as an artist to think about how you specify it, you know, how you get to grips with the universe. So mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm, I can't get enough of that.
Well, I have more I could go on about, but Walt, Mike, you guys got anything you want to add in?
I think Walt had a question.
Oh, yeah, I'm jumping out of my pants now that, you know, the caffeine's kicked in.
Oh, hey, run, run!
Yeah, right? Well, the first question I had was as far as, like, jump drive technology in the game,
yep.
As well as the universe, how does it work? I mean, I don't want you to give anything away so that, you know, fans are ruined when they get the book, but is it something where, you know, you hit a button and the space folds and now you're there, or is it time consuming, allowing for adventures and stories to be told while on the ship, while you're waiting for that travel to get done?
It's much more the second. Jump drives basically tear a hole in reality using the same abilities as an echo to basically travel through the wild where the primal dimension, where all the energy that powers echoes comes from, and tear a hole out the other side and appear in real space. One of the one of the things in the universe, and it's not really a secret, is that many of the kind of jump gates that are created that ships will fly through are there to hold the gate closed, not keep it open, because they've been torn through. The reality has been torn through so often, it's completely like ragged. It's like a ragged wound in reality. And ships, most, you know, they have gravity drives to transit from the world to the jump point. Then they jump through the wild, following a signal fire network, and that can take. You know, it can take weeks of travel. If you're going very cheap class, you might go cryogenic, whatever. But, you know, to get from one side of the Steel Alliance to the other would take sort of 4 years.
Oh, wow.
So there's lots of potential for, you know, kind of your haunted ship stories, your murders on the story, you know, sabotage on ship stories. Also, it's just more dramatic. I guess I think of them as like a really turbulent sea.
So you could do basically a whole campaign right on ship as they're traveling from one side of the Alliance to the other, complete with, like, you know, almost like a Battlestar Galactica kind of feel, where you have this group confined to this space and you need all these sections of society to make it work.
Yeah, and absolutely. One of our campaigns ended up having that in a very thing. Someone who'd been the most loyal kind of servant of an organization ended up becoming, through trying to do the right thing, the kind of arch traitor, and having to flee with a ship and essentially doing a mini Battlestar Galactica type thing. So they're still on the run.
Now, something you had said earlier about the way the world was working, when you said about the space exploration, yeah. You had said that since Echoes had expected to find habitable planets, therefore they would exist, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So does that apply across the board on the way you handle reality in the universe? If an Echo on my ship expects to find Cthulhoid horrors lurking in an ancient star field of asteroids and black matter, would that then be a possibility I could throw into my campaign because it would manifest as a result?
Yeah, well, so basically, the universe is considered morphic in mm-hmm. field. So essentially, you know, the official view is that all the systems they've colonized are the stars you can see in the sky. But there are other theories, and I talk about these in the timelines. There are other theories that, you know, most of the worlds that are colonized are different alternate versions of Earth, different locations. And it seems to be the further away you get from the core, the less stable things get, because basically the more people believe something to be the case, the more it is the case. With the core kind of worlds where you've got core populations who are used to the world being the way it is, it's very hard to change it. But as you go out beyond the edge of the Steel Alliance, stuff becomes very strange indeed. And that is partly to allow those kind of stories. You know, it's you know, I wanted a toolkit as a games master that would allow me the freedom to include those kind of elements. And there are, you know, whether there are the dark versions of supposedly dark versions of the disciples called the Rajadi, who are kind of supposedly demonic, you know, possess people. The way the disciples work is that they are creatures of energy who possess avatars, normally echoes, and most of the abilities they do are just ramped up echo abilities, and they burn through their avatars and discard them when they're done. And so they say there are evil demons called the Rajadi who are, you know, like, they're not like us, but they do the same thing, but they're definitely not related. And I love exploring the fact in the universe. When I write history stuff, I'll often put in little comments here and there saying, no, this bit's a lie, or this is an alternate theory, or, you know, because there is no single definition of truth in the universe. And that also gives me freedom as an author, but it also gives games groups a bit of freedom to tinker with it. And I want people to tinker with it.
Oh, for sure. Listen, I want everybody to understand the mind of the man that you're dealing with and how he writes here, because I just threw Amazon Canada's one click option and the Kindle app on my iPhone. I now have Dead Angels and Wild Hunt to read. And I just opened up Dead Angels, and the first two lines of this book are, her wings were spread. She was finally free. Immaculate in white against the turgid black of the Night River, she traveled upstream, driven by powerful tidal forces beyond her control. Now, if that doesn't make you want to read the rest of this book, I mean, I'm almost ready to go, okay, guys, bye, take care, I got some reading to do, take care, bye. I'm very impressed. As Walt well knows, and laughed maybe from a few conversations we've had, the core concept of a malleable reality is something that I find very important. Within the Zenith universe, we use something called quantum reality, which is a whole other story that I won't get into right now. But it's a similar sort of idea that the possibility exists. And our main character, Lady America, is essentially the best possible human. Whatever she does or whatever she's trained to be, she will be the best at it. That's her superpower. Mm-hmm. So for me to hear other writers talking about that, that malleable reality, I find something that I don't like in my fiction, I don't like in my role-playing, and I don't like in my world-building are these hard, solid boundaries that block creativity. I came up into acting through a lot of improv in college, and one of the things you never do in improv is you never block, you always yield. If you're staying around, someone says, this is a lovely haberdasher's, you don't go, this isn't the haberdasher's, it's a barbershop. You go, oh, yes, it is. Can I get you a hat? You know, you go with what's presented.
And that is actually, it's funny you mentioned that. That is one of the things that I've always held in my mind. It's the basis of good comedy. It's the basis of good acting. And, you know, I really strongly believe that when you put out a book, you know, a novel, when you put out the role-playing game, when you put out whatever, the graphic novel, it's no longer mine. So it's ours, it's shared. You know, I need to get, and so I have to, you know, someone, one of the things I always noticed that Angus, who runs Chronicle City, always said, you know, when you look at the stalls that they do at conventions and things, he'll say, you know, I'll say, it's a really good stall you've got. And he goes, it's not my stall, it's our stall. And he means it slightly facetiously, but what he means is that if you're sharing it, you're saying, hey, this is for everyone here, then you don't start saying, this is my stall, why are you here? You know, what are you doing? And I, you know, the best things that have come out of my worlds are the creative collaborations between the players and the games master. And what I don't want to do in my novels or my books is shut down people's imaginations, which is why I've always taken it as the highest kind of compliment that people look at, say, an illustration I did of one of my characters and say, nope, not them. And even though it's like, I based him off him, I wrote the description based on the picture, and they're like, yeah, that's really interesting, but no, you're wrong. And I think I just love that. I cannot get enough of that kind of thing. And I love seeing what people come up with. And I'm trying to work out how to do more of that with the world. I want to open it up in interesting ways. So I'm always looking at collaboration. So I'm talking about doing a collaboration with Misha Thomas, who's doing a game called Cold and Dark. You know, that's an excellent kind of really exciting kind of Dead Space, Pitch Black kind of Event Horizon kind of game. And, you know, we're looking at doing some overlaps and things like that and playing with each other's universes and stuff. But it's looking for things like that. That's what excites me as a creative person.
Nice. I like that a lot. That's sorry, guys. I know you guys want to talk about role-playing games, but, you know, me, I'm the creative mindset is always going to be the one that I zero in on. So let me just ask one more question, then you guys can talk about mechanics and campaigns and all that fun stuff. Have you, you know, at the beginning, I think Mike misspoke when he said Dieselpunk. Superpunk. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Now, when I think about superpunk, the first two things that jump into my mind when I think superpunk are certainly the Judge Dredd, the 2000 AD sort of world, and then the American version of that, which I don't know if you know, called martial law.
Yeah.
How hard would it be for someone to, if they're here, I'll tie it into gaming, if someone were to run a game and wanted to do a martial law style campaign, would that be something that, you know, Broken Shield could facilitate?
Yeah, one of the main divisions in the agency, which is the core organization you play, is the Marshals Division, you know, tasked with taking the law to the lawless. You know, films, there's the things that have inspired me over the years are very, you know, just all sorts of things. Judge Dredd, definitely. Another thing that inspired me, the Sean Connery movie Outland, where he's the federal marshal on Io.
That's high noon, yeah.
Yeah, and those kind of things. And we've done games like that, where you've played the only lawmaker on an entire world, or, you know, going out into the wilderness and things like that. Yeah, absolutely. We've done that. I love doing it, and I'm planning to flesh that out more as well. One of the things I'm planning with the game is seeing what people, because I've got about 50,000 words of stuff so far I've written on it. No, sorry, 50? I meant 500. 500,000 words of stuff I've got written on it. Sorry, each of my novels is like 100,000 or so. But which bit, and they're all going to come out eventually. It's all going, all the bits I'm writing are going to be released eventually, but which bits come out first is very much dependent on what players are most interested in, because I really want to, you know, if there's a particular bit that they're fascinated by, then, you know, that's great. That's great to me, and I'm going to get that out there. So, yeah, very interested in that kind of as a prospect, because it's fun. It's, you know, it's that playing a kind of Judge Dredd type character is pretty cool. It, as long as the universe supports it, and I think that the way I set it up, the universe does support it. We have a legal system which in the game, which I'm exploring more in an entire book, and one of the things that came to mind when I created it is, you know, when you create a real legal system, you're trying to create order out of chaos. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you're making a legal system in a game, then you're actually trying to create chaos so that the player can bring order to it. So, and that's what makes it fun. You don't want to tie their hands as players. You want to give them lots of opportunity to, you know, slam down the door, you know, kick down the door and say, you're coming with me for whatever they want, and just sort of explore that, but also have some kind of framework, you know, without it kind of being dry and dusty. So it's like, you know, exploring interesting sci-fi crimes like world cleansing or multicide, you know, when you've killed 13 people, that goes from being a single murder to being a multicide. But having a legal system that goes all the way from like littering to world cleansing is kind of amusing to write as well, and it entertains me as a writer.
Yeah, I'm curious if you ever saw a movie way back in the day called actually 91 called The Cast a Deadly Spell.
Oh yeah.
Yes. Fantastic twist. It's only available on video. I've been trying to get. I was really hoping they do a DVD or Blu-ray or something released, but it's never coming back.
I found a decent pirate bootleg of it, of a DVD file, that I was able to burn to a disc, and the audio quality and everything was just passable. But that is, seriously, it was one of the first HBO original films, one of the best HBO original films, and completely massacred by the sequel they did, Witch Hunt, which was just terrible by comparison.
Yeah.
I find I'm a lot happier if I pretend sequels don't exist for just about every movie.
Listen, LC, Laurent Castellucci, the editor on Zenith Comics, is the guy who introduced me to it. And to this day, 20 years later, he and I can still look at each other and go, nice tie, did it put up much of a fight? You know, like, that movie is just eminently quotable. No one I've shown that movie to has not loved it. So how do you tie that in, Laugh? I love this. Great concept.
Well, no, because we're talking about people with superpowers in a very noir setting. And, you know, obviously Cast a Deadly Spell, they have a backstory they hint at about how things change after the war. They don't go into great detail because the focus is on the noir action that's happening with the detective there in L.A. And that kind of reminded me of what we have with Broken Shield, because you have this great backstory and this, you know, galaxy-spanning alliance and superpowers and disciples. But it sounds like the focus for the game is really on your agents of the agency, you know, dealing with very noirish kind of crimes and investigations.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the other thing about mentioning a Cast a Deadly Spell is, of course, that's really Lovecraftian influence, and of course there's a little twist of Lovecraftian in what I do. The Wild Hunt has a little, you know, a few bit of supernatural bits in there which you'll get to, but I'm not going to spoil it.
I just bought the books, don't spoil it.
No, I'm not spoiling it. It's definitely, I mean, that's why I emphasize the noir. I mean, because the elements that I focus most in on the book is the agency, is the superhuman stuff, is the noir. The investigation stuff is stuff I'm building up as we go, but it's as I develop it further. But I want people solving those kind of crimes, and in fact, I'm just finishing off the introductory adventure to Broken Shield at the moment, and God, that's the hardest type of writing. Blending the systems, it's like the Venn diagram of the hardest bits of writing a thesis and writing fiction. When you write it as an introductory thing, you know, you need to set the tone. So I'm writing the fiction in the style of Gunnar Roxon and the system stuff in my personal style, if you see what I mean. And trying to blend the two together, and that very much does bring out that kind of noir element. You know, so there's some comedy in there, there's some extreme violence, there's threats that can rapidly evolve. You know, I went away over the weekend and watched LA Confidential and Casablanca again to get myself in the mood. You know, those are some of my influences in this. But I would have watched Cast a Deadly Spell, but I don't have any kind of copy of it or any kind of access to it. I saw it once ever, and I was like, oh my God. But
I just Googled, and it's available on YouTube.
But it's not a great quality copy on YouTube.
Sure, it's not. It's YouTube. But yeah.
I don't care. I'll watch it. Awesome.
Okay. Well, cool. Hey, I've got to wrap things up. Like I say sometimes when I do these it's daytime here in the U.S., and I have to get back to my corporate paymasters and fill out some TPS reports. Appreciate everybody coming by. Anything else you want to touch on before we call it a day?
No, I love talking to you guys. It's really interesting.
No, I'm really looking forward to reading your books, man. I'm really excited, actually, and sort of stoked because it's something different than what I've been filling my head with lately. Just to make sure that I'm pimping my stuff while I'm here. Google it, check the link, Zenith Comics Heroic Kickstarter. It's there, guys. If you want to see better heroes and you want to see superheroes that focus on the hero and not just the super, support this book. We're almost at 50% of our funding, 12 days left as of the recording of this podcast.
Well, I'm definitely going to check it out.
Well, thank you.
If we can build at your backer base one podcast at a time.
That's where you go. You have to build it one reader, one player at a time. Broken Shield and my novels will be on the Chronicle City stand at Gen Con in a couple of weeks' time. So, they'll be their Delta 14 books and Chronicle City working together. And as I say, it's going out to distribution, but it's available now on DriveThruRPG and also direct order hardbacks.
Very nice, very nice. Walt, you've been uncharacteristically quiet. Anything you want to chime in with over there?
No, I've just been geeking out on all this stuff. So, I definitely think we should do a part two with Mr. Rollins and explore this game a little more and explore the tie-in with the novels. If anybody would be cool with that, I'd be cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe that can be an after Gen Con kind of thing.
Yeah.
Nice.
Okay, cool. Well, hey, folks, thanks for tuning in, and I appreciate all my guests for joining me this afternoon, and we'll catch you next time on the BAMF Podcast.